When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Fortune's Wheel, a podcast history of the late Middle Ages, and I'm Jonathan. On the last episode, we established several key points that would guide us toward the seismic, and some would say inevitable, collision between Eastern Islam and Western Christianity. First, Alexander II's death coincided with rumors of Robert Guiscard's death in 1073. Second, Archdeacon Hildebrand, mastermind and string puller of so much over the previous two decades, he was sitting on the cusp of what he'd longed for all along. And third, young Matilda in Tuscany had been raised in the highest courts of medieval Italy and Germany. Now in this episode, we will see how all this plays out. We will largely stay between spring and Christmas of 1073, but just wait and see the sheer number of moving parts the new pope is juggling in this short time period. But there's just one more thing to make crystal clear before we begin, and it's a point that simply cannot be overstated. The papacy of Pope Gregory VII was a period defined by papal imperialization. Few other popes in history would do more to expand the imperial aspirations than did Gregory VII. This is episode 122, entitled The Holy Satan's First Year, Part 1. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. So we're going to begin this episode with a quote, and I really do love this quote, especially given the context of the quote. It says, quote, "Robert Guiscard must have enjoyed dictating his letter," end quote. This is from John Julius Norwich in his book, The Other Conquest, which personally, again, it brings me a bit of laughter because Robert Guiscard knew the letter would reach Hildebrand's eyes and shock the aging archdeacon. The message that was lurking beneath that letter was nothing other than, "Thank God we're rid of that cursed Norman." I imagine Robert Guiscard was thinking the same thing, probably laughing as he dictated his response. But in reality, Robert was eager to reestablish the old papal Norman alliance. It had been a number of years, and with everything that has happened since, especially since Pope Alexander II passed away recently, he wanted to get Hildebrand and the new pope in front of him and get something supportive and mutually beneficial in writing. A priest named Desiderius was the abbot of the abbey at Monte Cassino, and he'd been the longtime liaison between Rome and Melfi, all the way back to Count Humphrey de Hauteville, and it was this abbot Desiderius who once again played the role of intermediary between the two factions. Unfortunately, nothing could be put into place until a new pope was elected. While Desiderius did the unthinkably difficult task of setting up peaceful meetings between the Romans and the Normans, Archdeacon Hildebrand was deeply invested in who the College of Cardinals would elect as the new pope. But in addition to this election, which is only the second election by the College of Cardinals since its founding, there was turmoil up north in Milan for the past year, and it involved the insufferable Germans. See, a year earlier, in 1072, there was a bit of a kerfuffle in naming a new archbishop of the prominent northern city. The Pope's faction wanted one guy, and almost had him, when the German monarchy stepped in once again. By this time, Henry IV had the crown for a handful of years, so this one is squarely on him. King Henry IV invested, key word there, invested the archbishopric, which Henry IV, though still a German king and not yet a Holy Roman Emperor, mind you, claimed as his own imperial domain. So, after all those reforms laid out by Hildebrand through the papacies of Nicholas II and Alexander II had been challenged, well, directly now by Henry IV. Henry knew what he was doing when he placed his choice in Milan. What he did flew in the face of the Lenten Synod of 1059, where Nicholas II outlawed investiture, which was the ability of a monarch or a nobleman to simply place whoever they wanted in a clerical position. You can see why this would be rather tricky, rather corrupt, you could say. And well, yeah, that's just the best word for it. Investiture was corruption. To boot, his choice had publicly spoken out against these reforms, and he belonged not to the clergy, but to the German aristocracy. Norwich writes, quote, "Tensions between the two parties had led to the burning of the Milan Cathedral, and tempers were still running high on each side when, in April 1073, Alexander died, leaving his successor to carry on that struggle." End quote. Now, I've been a bit dodgy in my explanation of what Hildebrand was up to with the College of Cardinals, but, to be honest, everyone, and I think it's safe to say pretty much everyone, knew exactly who was going to be elected the new pope there in the spring of 1073. Archdeacon Hildebrand had been at the top of the papal game, aside from wearing the silly hat himself, for the better part of 20 years. I hope I've been effective enough in my storytelling to get that across accurately. It had always been Hildebrand. It could only ever be Hildebrand in 1073. So Norwich gives us the basics, but Michelle Spike, in her book, Tuscan Countess, The Life and Extraordinary Times of Matilda of Canossa, lays out the situation in far more detail. She writes about a church in Rome named the Basilica di San Pietro in Vincola. This was a church built on top of a church, built on top of a church, built on top of a church, all the way up to today. Matilda of Canossa, also known again as Matilda of Tuscany and Matilda of Mantua, as I've said before. Matilda of Canossa in this church, this Basilica di San Pietro di Vincola, would be at the site of an enormously important moment in Archdeacon Hildebrand's life. Spike writes, quote, "Matilda would have known of this church in a much different form as the site that preserved the holy relic of the chains of Herod that bound St. Peter to the walls of a jail in Jerusalem in the Acts of the Apostles, which is chapter 12, verses 1 through 11. An angel miraculously loosed these chains from Peter's wrists and led him through the three guarded doors out of Herod's prison. Today, the chains hang in a crystal and gilded chest within the main altar. This church, with the poetically evocative name St. Peter in Chains, is relevant to our story for another reason. It was in this space, during the funeral mass of Pope Alexander II and before the body of that pope had even been laid in his grave, that Hildebrand became Pope Gregory VII." End quote. So basically, it went down like this. A monk stood and interrupted the funeral proceedings of Alexander. All eyes on the monk. He was recognized as Ugo Candida of Remiremont, a man who had accompanied Bruno of Toul and Hildebrand into the city of Rome decades earlier, when Bruno, if you remember, became Pope Leo IX. Spike calls his words, quote-unquote, "flaming oratory," and says the following to those in attendance. This is what Ugo Candida of Remiremont had said to everybody in the middle of the funeral. He says, quote, "Brothers, you know from the days of Pope Leo that Hildebrand has always exalted the Holy Roman Church. There is no one we can elect who is better or equal to him. Elect him now in this church, a man who is known to us and approved by us all." End quote. She tells us that Bishop Bonazzoni of Sutri wrote in 1085, just 10 years after this, that everyone rushed Hildebrand, grabbed him, and screamed things like, "Hildebrand Bishop," and "God has chosen the Pope." However, Hildebrand himself, writing before Bonazzoni in 1085 described the scene differently. He writes, quote, "For after he," that is Pope Alexander II, "for after he had died, the Roman people, contrary to their custom, placed the conduct of affairs in my hands so quietly that it was evidently done by a special act of divine grace." End quote. That's from Spike, by the way. So who should we believe? The bishop or Hildebrand himself? What I think matters more is that either way, Hildebrand was elevated to the papacy informally before the College of Cardinals could even convene for a day one of deliberations on electing a new pope. What matters more is that Hildebrand accepted, despite his own pet project being thrust through, the pet project being the College of Cardinals itself. So, what was the point of the College of Cardinals if the creator of it didn't even use it? Well, this wasn't lost on him, so, as archdeacon, he still convened the college, but, I mean, come on, at that point it was all a formality. But, as Spike tells us, things had to be done, and they had to be done quickly, and figuring out who would be the holiest among them to lead the church was the least of their concerns. I found that funny. Just weeks before Alexander's death, Alexander had signed the excommunication of five bishops, five German bishops. Alexander's death was blood in the water to King Henry IV. Again, there was no time to waste. On May 25th, 1073, the College of Cardinals voted in the one man who could lead them through the next phase of the papal imperial Norman Byzantine story. That's a big, complicated story. Archdeacon Hildebrand accepted the election. It takes time to plan and create the necessary pomp and circumstance befitting a new pope, but on June 29th, it would all begin. That day, Hildebrand, as a matter of course and not necessity, if you can believe it, Hildebrand was ordained a priest within the Catholic Church. Yeah, all of those years, he held other positions, most notably monk and deacon, but he had never formally been ordained. And to become pope at the time, I don't know if it's the same today, but at the time, you didn't need to be an ordained priest. To me, that was kind of a shock, but maybe it's not to our Catholic listeners. So yeah, I guess going back on what I just said, if it's the same today or not, here's what it states. According to the Code of Canon Law, still in effect today, it states the following, quote, "A baptized male alone receives sacred ordination validly," end quote, when it comes to be elected the Bishop of Rome, that is. So, however that's interpreted, I personally would interpret it as it's the same as when Hildebrand was around. You just need to be a baptized male. That's it. So yeah, on June 29th, 1073, just to add a little more to Hildebrand's CV, he became a priest. And then the very next day, on June 30th, with, again, Matilda of Canossa in attendance, along with her mother Beatrice, Archdeacon Hildebrand became forever more known as Pope Gregory VII. And if I hadn't made it clear on previous episodes, including those on Patreon, Michelle Spike's work, Tuscan Countess, is, in my humble opinion, next to none when it comes to medieval biographies. It's just absolutely phenomenal. So I highly encourage you all to grab a copy for yourself, as I haven't even scratched the surface. And it was in this ceremony, I learned from Spike's book, it was in this ceremony that Hildebrand became Gregory VII that we see a real clue that could lead us to explain Matilda's relationship with Hildebrand previously and going forward. See, as Hildebrand went through the traditions, as he prostrated himself on the floor, as he wore the shepherd's cloak and received the ring, as he publicly declared that he would forevermore live in accordance with the rules of the church, including that of celibacy, we see Matilda in the midst of her own inner turmoil, married to a man she was forced to marry, a man, despite our modern sensibilities, a man she was disgusted by due to his spinal defect. One can possibly understand the connection she had to Hildebrand in that moment. We will discuss their relationship in the future, but to me this seems a It seems a plausible origin point for the deep connection these two both developed for one another. Spike writes, quote, "Matilda viewed the solemn ceremony from the perspective of her personal, problematic situation and saw her salvation in the person of this new pope," end quote. Personally, I take some pause in that last statement because Matilda would play out this idea for the rest of her days when it came to her marital status and her absolute unquestioning devotion to not only the Catholic Church, but also, and arguably more importantly, to her devotion to that man, Pope Gregory VII, formerly known as Hildebrand. Now, if Hildebrand was feeling the same connection in those moments as Matilda was mere feet away, sitting right up front of the distinguished guests of his at his greatest accomplishment, we just don't know. We don't know how he was feeling exactly, but it isn't hard to imagine that Hildebrand being a man, it must have been difficult to not feel anything for Matilda. They were, after years, already on pretty friendly terms. Clearly disgusting to us today, but not to them then. Hildebrand had watched Matilda grow from adolescent to young woman. A woman Spike describes as, quote, "a renowned beauty, fully aware of her physical charm," end quote. She goes on to say Matilda had become, quote, "rich, self-confident, and very, very feminine, slim a figure, lithe and alluring," end quote. She was intensely engaging and intelligent as well. Throw in, as Spike says, some, quote-unquote, "deep blue eyes," and you have an absolute knockout, right? How could Hildebrand not notice? In my estimation, I mean, he noticed. Come on, he noticed. Spike continues with this, quote, "had Matilda been merely a pretty face, she would no doubt have left Rome without making any significant impression on the Pope. As it was, she stood out above all others by reason of her literacy and her intelligence, and she dangled a political opportunity that absolutely captivated the new pontiff," end quote. Oh yeah, there's that too. Because it's definitely worth noting that her husband, Duke Godfrey III, the Hunchback, if you remember, well, he was a firm loyalist of King Henry IV, so there's that little kink in the marriage too. Matilda couldn't find anyone she probably despised more than her 4 years younger pipsqueak punk of a cousin, a guy who terrorized her when she was younger and a prisoner in his dad's home. Oh, and Henry IV's dad was the guy rumored to have ordered the assassination of Matilda's beloved father, too. So, yeah, there's that baggage as well. Did I mention that Matilda's husband was in Tuscany at the time of Gregory's ascension to the papacy? But he refused to go in order to publicly protest on behalf of the German king? Yeah, it escalated to that level as well. So, I guess beyond Matilda and back to Hildebrand here, Spike also gives us insight into Hildebrand's namesake, Firebrand, or the firebrand of a personality, that is, when she explains why he chose Gregory as his papal moniker. So why Gregory, right? First, a little background for those who don't know or for non-Catholics. It's something I never really knew until a few years ago. Why do people change their names when they become pope? The tradition started with Jesus himself, actually, when he gave one of his apostles, a man named Simon, the name Peter. Yes, this is the same Saint Peter we know so much about today, the one crucified upside down at the side of the Vatican, all that. Jesus said that Simon, or at that point now Peter, would quote-unquote be the rock upon which my church will be built. Why Peter, though? Well, Peter was a Greek derivative, actually. Dig deep into your memories of etymology studies in high school. Peter, P-E-T-R, that is the Greek root meaning rock, as in words like petroglyph or petroleum. So, Simon became, almost literally, by name, the rock upon which Jesus' church would be built, or simply, Peter. He's also known as Simon Peter. This tradition has continued down to us today. Every man who has assumed the role of Pope has shed his former self and become a singular force for God's work here on earth. That's one way to look at it. And I've known their names have had double meanings. I mean, names like Victor and Honorius and Benedict clearly have specific meanings, but others are much more obscure, especially those really weird ones from the early Middle Ages and late antiquity, with names like Vigilius and Telesphorus and Eleutherius and Miltiades. Those are some of my favorites. And we cannot forget the Pope with the name Hilarius. I kind of like that one too. So what about the name Gregory? Why did Hildebrand choose Gregory the VII? Spike thinks he chose this name precisely because it was controversial, which is enlightening considering who we're talking about. Remember, his given name was a Lombard translation of Firebrand. He had no issues, in name or deed, with making people squirm. Spike writes, quote, Hildebrand chose the name Gregory, which means one who cares for the flock, grex, meaning flock in Latin, greco, to care for in Greek, right? But this motivation was purely political. By naming himself the seventh Pope Gregory, Hildebrand ratified the legitimacy of his uncle's papacy, rejecting the ignominious deposition in 1046 that sent Gregory the VI into exile and death by order of King Henry III. The name was a deliberate provocation. End quote. Hildebrand, Gregory the VII. He was poking the German bear, probably giggling as he did it. He knew what he was doing here. So this one was far less about the meaning of the name and more about the implications of assuming the name. And this wouldn't be the last time this would happen. Many listening today lived through the papacy of Pope John Paul II. He was pope for the first 24 years of my life, personally. In a much different context than Hildebrand's choice of Gregory, Pope John Paul II chose the name as a way to respect the popular Pope John Paul I before him, who had died after just 33 days as pope. Pope John Paul II felt that his predecessor's papacy in life was just cut far too short and felt that he would continue this man's potential legacy. So popes choose their names for a variety of reasons. But back to Hildebrand. Gregory was a giant hawked loogie in the face of the German crowd. Let's not mince words here. It was, and it was purposeful. And Hildebrand had already, over the course of 20 years in Rome, made abundantly clear his disdain for the Germans thinking they ruled all of Christendom. There are no Charlemagnes in the 11th century. In light of all this, there is one seemingly minor aspect to the story that we can't get out of here not talking about, and we've kind of already touched on it already. The connection between Gregory the VII and Matilda of Tuscany. Again, I know I've alluded to it and hinted at it and finally just come right out and said it, but it bears repeating that the connection between these two would be a driving force for much of what happens next, if only to explain why Gregory the VII did what he did or was where he would be. That's a key one too. How on earth, though, would we ever even know of such a thing? These two being so close. Well, let's first begin with Matilda's prominent standing in Italian politics at the time, and it was still growing when he became pope, but it would continue to grow. Spike says, quote, given the scarcity of the 11th century documents, it is remarkable how many records exist from 1072 alone of Beatrice holding court with Matilda by her side, resolving disputes and confirming land transfers, end quote. We have the documents to prove that she was at the top of the game, or at least by 1073, she was adjacent to the top of the game. As for what we know about Matilda's relationship to the new pope, well, Spike continues with, quote, do I know what transpired on those days in June of 1073? No one does. But I can say that in the aftermath of these encounters, curious events started to unfold. The affair began slowly, under the watchful eyes of all of Rome. The papal court generated a constant stream of gossip that kept their relationship in the news, as effectively as a romance reported weekly in People magazine, end quote. To boot, she adds the proof of how we know what we know. She says, quote, Gregory's official correspondence, which he himself preserved in chronological order, documents these years. And these documents and letters, well, they show two sides of Pope Gregory VII. He had championed reform for decades. He had orchestrated it all from the wings, and now that he was in charge, he would not relent, like not even a little. Publicly, he railed against the crimes outlined by his predecessor, Alexander II, specifically those of simony and the sexual relations regarding priests and plurality. However, in his letters to Matilda, of which there were quite numerous letters, he was a completely different man. There was a tenderness, to use Spike's description, that his other documents hardly showed. And it's worth mentioning that Gregory VII never acknowledged, at least in his correspondence, he never acknowledged the marriage of Matilda and Godfrey III, except for just one letter regarding a situation we will outline by the end of this episode, when the Pope was asking for support against an old papal agitator. But we'll get there soon. Still, just one time he went on record acknowledging Matilda's marriage to another man. I think that says something. Unfortunately, we do not have any of Matilda's letters back to Gregory. We only have the Pope's. All we know of Matilda's stance on her beloved Pope was what she had her priest Donizoni write in her Gesta Matildis, her biography. So back to what we know. We know that between the festivities of late June to mid-July, when Matilda and her mother Beatrice were in Rome to witness Hildebrand's big day, and between that and Christmas of 1073, 6 months later, there was no communication between the two. Was it to quell any rumors? To me, that seems to be the case, as Pope Gregory VII began his papacy with a flurry of activity, most notably one that flies in the face of the outward appearance of his relationship with young Matilda of Tuscany. It's almost purposefully done this way. See, he issued an order, like right away, throughout Christendom, effective immediately, that any priest across Christendom was at that moment prohibited by papal decree to be alone with a woman behind closed doors. Yeah, he doubled down. And then he tripled down when he included in that decree that he will refuse any appeals for divorce. Now think about that. He had already been behind closed doors with Matilda on a few occasions, right? He had already not acknowledged Matilda and Gregory III's marriage. And records indicate she had been asking for a divorce anyway. And then he gets to be Pope officially in late June, and he immediately makes those two stances. But see, I bring this up for good reason. Seen in this light, the rest of Gregory VII's papacy will be one full of contradictions and intrigue. Spike points out that in her letter to the Pope around Christmas of 1073, Matilda basically asks that if Gregory VII will not grant her a divorce from Godfrey III, then what other course is there than to give herself to God fully and join a nunnery? Well, Gregory VII wouldn't have it. In his return letter in February of 1074, he outright said no to her joining a nunnery and followed it up with this. Keep in mind his recent decrees about priests and women. He followed it up with how he wished her to stay close to his council, that he alone, if needed, will care for her and keep her safe. Hildebrand was already a profoundly complex man, but this opens up a whole new complexity with which we must contend when making sense of his papacy and his legacy. Again, full of contradictions and full of intrigue. Now, as these letters crisscross the northern Italian countryside between the Pope and a married woman, noblewoman, the spurned husband should have stepped in immediately, wouldn't you think? The problem was that Duke Godfrey III of Lorraine in Tuscany, Matilda's husband, was actually not even in Tuscany at that particular time. See, back in August of 1073, just after Matilda and her mother Beatrice returned from their celebrations with the new Pope Gregory VII in Rome, In August, Saxony, up in Germany, erupted in rebellion. So there's a lot of history as to why. This was not some isolated rebellion by some wannabe nobleman. This harkened back to previous German kings and how Saxony, the home to the famous Ottonian line of kings that ended in the early years of the 11th century, still held claim to the throne of Germany. This resentment at the line of Conrad, the Salian line to be exact, never abated. So you've got the old Ottonians, and they're still a little bitter that the Salian lines took over when Conrad II took over. They still held out hope, these Saxons, that they would reinstall one of their own Ottonian line back on the throne. And with a young, inexperienced Henry IV at the helm, they thought it a perfect time, you know, to raise a little Cain. In fact, they struck at the very palace young Henry IV was staying in at the time. It was, in Spike's words, quote-unquote, a royal retreat in the Harz Mountains that was taken from the Saxons by Henry's father, King Henry III. It turns out that Henry IV had escaped within an inch of his life and made his way to a monastery in Hersfeld. It was at this point that Godfrey III left sunny Tuscany and made his way north to assist his king. He departed on August 18, 1073. This would be the last time Matilda would ever see her husband. Not that she would be too bothered by that. Now, the situation between the German king and the Saxon nobility was so severe, such a threat to his reign, that it forced Henry IV to make some big boy decisions. He needed as much support as he could get. Like, this was a serious rebellion. So he decided to accept Pope Gregory VII's election. That's a big one. And admit he was at fault for everything that happened in Milan, including the burning down of the Milan Cathedral a few years earlier. Also a huge one, right? Well, this was mighty big of the young, petulant king, and Gregory promptly accepted the king's appeal for peace, shall we call it. But that same month of August, when everything in Germany blew up, something else came to a boil just south of Rome. As he first donned the silly hat, Gregory VII had a serious issue to deal with. The Normans. Yes, always the Normans. Thus, we return to Abbot Desiderius of Monte Cassino and his insufferable task of getting the Normans and the Pope in the same room without tearing each other to pieces. See, Gregory VII wished to meet Duke Robert in Benevento, just north of Apulia. That is, outside of Robert's domains. Robert agreed until he heard rumors of an assassination attempt in the making. He then refused to step foot inside the city of Benevento and agreed to a meeting outside the city. Gregory VII thought the idea beneath him, to say the least. Norwich writes, quote, "Poor Desiderius must have had a thankless task, shuttling backwards and forwards between these two determined and mutually suspicious characters, arguing and cajoling with each in turn, in the relentless heat of a Campanian August," end quote. And due to these two men being as stubborn as they come, dealings fell through, and it's very likely that Gregory VII and Robert Guiscard failed to meet face-to-face in August of 1073. After this, the entire Norman papal alliance was all but finished, at least for the time being. It was probably the absolute worst way to start off his papacy, to be honest. As has been unquestionably clear for at least 30 years, the Pope needed Norman allies. In the summer of 1073, he did not have the most powerful Norman in southern Italy on good terms with him. He still had Richard of Capua, but Guiscard was the absolute, undisputed Norman leader in the region. Here's the thing, though. Norwich points out that the actual words exchanged by the dutiful Desiderius between the two men was without question cordial, leading Norwich to entertain the fact that the two men genuinely wanted a good relationship with each other. But it fell through. I mean, that's business. No ill feelings, but negotiations just didn't work out this time. They didn't work out this time. However, one thing is clear. Gregory VII did not return to Rome immediately after the Benevento debacle. Nope, Instead, Gregory VII made straight for Richard of Capua, the other Norman leader in Italy. And there, the two men agreed upon a pact to confront Robert Guiscard in Apulia. Now let's switch gears just for a moment, because once Gregory VII returned to Rome in late August of 1073, he read an urgent letter from the emperor himself. As you know, by this time, Romanus IV had royally whiffed at Manzikert exactly 2 years earlier, and had his eyes gouged out, resulting in his death 5 months later. Since then, the former emperor Constantine X Ducas's son, now named Michael VII Ducas, had, in August 1071, assumed the Byzantine crown. This letter was an appeal to Rome to raise an army to help fight against the Seljuk Turks who were moving their way west across Anatolia toward the capital of Constantinople. Essentially, the appeal was framed in a religious manner. Stop me if you've heard this type of thing before. Essentially, Michael VII, no doubt at the guidance of chronicler Michael Psellus, who, yes, was still advising the Byzantine emperor after all these years and all those emperors. Well, Emperor Michael VII was appealing to Pope Gregory VII to raise a Christian army to push back and possibly destroy a Muslim army. By definition, this is an appeal for a crusade. And Gregory VII had the letter in his own hands asking for one to be called in 1073. Now, for those playing at home, that is a full 22 years before Pope Urban II, who, no doubt, was walking around the streets of Rome at this time, would call for what would become the actual First Crusade. Norwich writes, quote, "Gregory was deeply affected by the appeal. The two churches might be in schism, but he still considered himself responsible before God for the entire Christian world. Besides, this was a heaven-sent opportunity to bring the Byzantines back once again into the Roman fold, and he was determined not to let it pass him by. On the other hand, he could not possibly launch an effective crusade in the East while he was under a constant threat at home from Robert Guiscard and his Normans." End quote. Yep, the only reason that the First Crusade wasn't launched 22 years earlier and by Gregory VII and not Urban II was because of, that's right, Robert Guiscard. Because of course it had to be Robert Guiscard. Now on the next episode, we pick up on the second part of the Holy Satan's first year as Pope, and we find out how all this plays out. We'll see Gregory's response to Emperor Michael VII, and we'll find out why Robert Guiscard was once again throwing a wrench in the Pope's spokes. And I can't wait to tell you about it.